Wednesday, July 14th, was my day for work on my talking machine. I spent most of it in my little back bedroom, doing work that should have been done over many days. And then sometime in the early afternoon came a tolling bell that arrests first your heart and then your thinking. A flash over the radio that Adlai Stevenson had collapsed walking in a park in London in Grosvenor Square with Marietta Tree and died almost immediately. After that, the day went on just as we'd planned, but with my mind absent, thinking about the mortality of man, even the most important man, the times I'd spent with him, how very much I liked him, how would the UN get along without him. I went to the little beauty parlor in Stonewall, putting one foot in front of the other, sleepwalking a bit. It's nice they have one there now, knowing how heavily this fell upon London, the death of someone who, in spite of how very different they were, he liked a lot, of London's own heart attack, of the rushing imperative to appoint someone to fill his post. It was cloudy, and we could hope for rain. We needed it very much, but for the night, personally, I hoped it would hold off until 10 o'clock, because we'd invited all the professors from the University of Texas who had worked together on the little booklet called A President's Country. They came at 6:30, the bright, get-things-done Jack McGuire's, without whom the book would never have been thought of or reached the presses. The Henderson Shufflers, he's the historian, back, that is, to the beginnings of Texas. And then the anthropologists, I suppose that's the right word, the Newcombs and Curtis Tunnell. That chapter was the real old-timers were red men, and it appears they've been in the Pedernales Valley about 12,000 years. Then the land itself, the flora and fauna, where the deer and the Pisano play. Gerald Rawn collaborated with Newcomb on this, and Drury Alexander, the architect, described the German architecture and its blending with the Old South, and the geologist Peter Flawn, who did almost my favorite chapter, The Everlasting Land. And then there were the publishers, the designers, photographers, and the Mac Tatchells. He's a Britisher who's only been in this country a few years, but whose drawings are delightful. We had cocktails and spare ribs around the pool, and Noche's specials, and a rediscovery of Texas, some of the best conversation I've had in weeks. No protocol was possible. We filled our plates with barbecue and sat down at tables of six or four. Among the interesting stories was one Henderson Shuffler told me about the quality of men who were the founding fathers in Washington on the Brazos in 1836. Quite a few graduates from Harvard and Yale, he told me. George Washington's great-great-nephew was among the settlers close to there, somewhere on the Brazos. And the only Texas senator who refused to ratify the treaty, bringing Texas into the United States in 1845, was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin. Something that excited me was Curtis Tunnell's story about caves in the Trans-Pecos area, most of which will soon be covered when the reservoir of the Amistad Dam backs up. There are pictographs in them made by men 4,000 years ago, according to the carbon tests. The colors still vivid, reds and blacks. They show hunting scenes, men hunting deer, long spears with flint points. Bows and arrows weren't invented till around 500 A.D. There are scenes of gods, or shaman, as they often call them. And some hilarious ones are fishing scenes with a catfish 8 feet long. We wondered if the catfish actually grew that long in those days, or if this particular fisherman was like so many and just using his imagination about that fish he'd caught. In the caves are also elephant bones and sandals and corn cobs of tiny corn. They're all on land owned by ranchers, none of it by the federal government or the state government. The ranchers have in many instances been very cooperative and nice to the anthropologists and scientists that come out on expeditions from universities, but they're getting a little tired of having the gate left open and the cattle and sheep getting out, and occasional tourists wander in and asking if they can't just look for an arrowhead or a clay pot for their little grandson back home. And then the waters of the Amistad Reservoir will creep over it all in 3 or 4 years. And not even Bill Douglas or Stuart Udall are raising a hue and cry to stop it. I asked Curtis Turnell if he'd ever been in a cave and found pictures that he felt no human had seen in hundreds and hundreds of years. He grinned most delightfully and said yes, he had. There was one cave that was so inaccessible they named it No Goat Cave because not even any goat could get into it. But he devised a way by climbing a tree, a sapling, that would bend over when his weight got close to the top, such a point that he could drop into the lip of the cave, and then secure a rope, and with help below, make his way out. And in it he had found and photographed exciting things. I loved it all and was ready to leave tomorrow. All of it makes me think of the many things I shall find to do with my day and my energy when I once more live here. And more I believe it is possible, even happy, for Lyndon to retire when we finish this job, and God help us to finish it. The main point of the evening was to say thank you to all these people for an extremely high-class, literate, beautiful job about a land I love. I was disappointed to find there'd only been about 8,000 copies of the book sold. The university press does not attempt to commercialize. It seeks no outlets, no advertising, apparently. I think that is regrettable. I wish they'd make it available in every place that sells souvenirs, and also in Brentano's. But it was a good evening and a job I was glad to do. I'd had calls from both Linda and Lucy that afternoon. Lucy saying she was going straight home from work to comfort her daddy, to be on hand for anything she could do for him. Linda, in tears, talking about Adlai and how much she'd liked him the last time they'd been together, and that she wanted to come be with us for whatever services they were. And then a long, long talk about her stay at the Grand Tetons, which is lengthened from 3 or 4 days to a week. In fact, Brent Eastman, whom I'd found so attractive last summer, has made it an interesting time for Linda Bird. On the raft down the Snake River, at a square dance, at a campfire picnic, her conversation was full of him. So I went to bed feeling older and tireder, glad that I'd met a facet of the University of Texas, a bright and lively facet, and said thank you, and my thoughts winging toward Lyndon, for whom this had so many implications. I called him, but it was not a very satisfactory call. Hurried, I cannot comfort over the phone. I told him I wanted to cut short my trip and return for services whenever and wherever.